The shaper, Githra Dahl, looked upon Savang La's arm and hesitated. The War Master knew the news would be unfavorable. He could feel the increased activity of the carrion eaters in his arm, could see and feel the emergence of new spines in the Yuuzhan Vong flesh above the join.
"Speak," he said. "Your words cannot anger me, nor your conclusions. If they are presented in a quick and correct fashion, you have nothing to fear from me."
The shaper bowed in gratitude.
"It is growing worse, War Master. I fear for your arm. All my shaper's arts are not saving it."
"So, I am doomed to become one of the shamed ones."
Savang La leaned forward on his chair, staring off into the distance, into the future, paying the shaper no more mind.
"No, that will never happen. When my arm is at its worst, but before I am truly among the shamed, I will offer myself in sacrifice, or throw myself against the enemy and die appropriately. My only concern now is to support a new War Master who could lead the Yuuzhang Vong ably and well."
He cupped his chin in his good hand and considered.
"I think Gukandar Huath will serve best, don't you?"
It was a ploy. Gukandar Huath was a fine warrior and war leader, but was well known for the support he offered the priests of Yun Yamka and Yun Harla, and for his barely disguised indifference to the creator god, Yun Yuuzhan. If, in fact, Githra Dahl was part of some conspiracy with Yun Yuuzhan's priests, he would be forced now to offer.
"If I may, War Master, I said that the Shaper's craft was inadequate to the task, not that you were doomed," Githra Dahl said. "You may have one other avenue left to you, and it is an avenue of attack, not an avenue of retreat."
Savang La considered the shaper as if he'd just been reminded that he was still there. He did not allow any hope to creep into his expression or tone.
"Speak, my servant."
Githra Dahl lowered his tone, as if to thwart eavesdroppers.
"The Shaper's arts cannot help you, I am certain, because the one force in the universe more powerful than those arts afflicts you. The will, the anger of the gods is what you suffer."
"No, Githra Dahl. I bring victory to the twin gods, and they know that soon I will have a twin sacrifice for them. Their priests tell me of the gods' pleasure with my successes."
"Their priests, yes. Their priests rejoice, and the priests of Yun Yamka anticipate your father's victories in the Pyria system, so that they may occupy the rich world there. But though they are the gods whose names are most upon the lips of our warriors and great leaders, they are not the only gods."
Savang La settled back in his chair and allowed some doubt to become evident in his voice.
"Of course they are not. We have many gods. But what could I have done to offend any of them? I have offered no defiance to them, no curses."
"You have, I suspect you have, neglected some. Offering sacrifices not quite in proportion to their greatness. The twin gods, blessed and mighty may their names be, give a success, and you celebrate success. But another gave you life, and you do not seem to celebrate that life."
"Yun Yuuzhan? But his myriad eyes do not focus upon us so closely, so the priests say."
"So some of the priests say. And if they are wrong, If following their opinions has angered Yun Yuzhan, you might continue to follow their advice until it truly does doom you.
Some of the priests. Do you know any who preach a different discipline?
I do. He is young, perhaps not known to you. His name is Takaf Ul.
I know of him.
Savang La looked at the joint of his arm and considered it for a long moment.
I will speak with him. You are dismissed.
But I must remain to see the effects of my latest treatment.
You have just said that the Shapar's arts are not relevant here. Your latest treatment will fail. So there is no reason for you to stay and monitor that failure.
Savang La gestured toward the exit from the chamber. With another bow, Githra Dahl withdrew. The portal stretched open to permit his departure. Before it had closed again, when Githra Dahl could still hear, Savang La thundered,
"Summon Takaf Ul to me."
Then it was closed. No one moved to do his bidding. Nor were his guards and closest advisors supposed to. They had been carefully instructed in what to do, how to act. Takaf Ul would indeed be summoned, but only in a few minutes. Another portal widened, and Nen Yim entered at a hurried pace. She was a woman of the Yuzhan Vang and a member of the Shaper caste. Her teacher, Mijan Kwa'ad, had been a maverick, disobedient to the rulers of the Yuzhan Vang, contemptuous of the gods, and this was both a blessing and a curse. A blessing because Nen Yim had learned many secrets of the Shaper's craft that would have been forbidden by a more cautious teacher. A curse because Nen Yim carried some of the suspicion resulting from the revelation of her teacher's treason. Once at his side, she pulled tool creatures from her garments and headdress and began scraping and prodding at his arm, just at the join, taking flesh, capturing flesh eaters. At any other time, touching him without permission would have been a crime punishable by the most ignoble of deaths. But he had instructed her to do so, to waste no time with words. He ignored her and turned to Danua Koo, who stood as if on guard duty among his other bodyguards.
Was it done?
Danua Koo bowed his head.
It was. I flung the Tracia spine ray onto his back, and he did not react, did not acknowledge its presence. It will spawn within minutes, and its spawn will spread.
The War Master nodded, satisfied. It was not enough to take the heads of the traitors he already knew and suspected. He would have to tear this conspiracy out by the roots so that it could not grow again. The agony the conspirators felt in the last weeks of their lives, the shame they and their families would bear, would become legendary among the Yuzhan Vang. Now a crew of men and women, most of the same species as the tall man, but some furrier or rounder, labored at the black wall. One of them used a flame device like Rook's to heat the wall. Then he nodded and stepped back, and a woman stepped up and used her own device. Whiteness sprayed from the hose she held. The hose attached to the tank on her back, and the air got cold, very cold. The whiteness struck the heated stone. The stone shrieked. The tall man liked the sound of that. But only a small bit of the stone fell free. The tall man picked it up. It stung his fingers with lingering heat. It was heavy, far heavier than stone should be. The man and the woman looked over the tiny crack formed in the wall's surface. They made noises at one another. Then the woman, apprehension on her face, turned to the tall man, making thoughts. The tall man reached out and plucked them forth. The hot and cold would succeed, she told him. in a long time. What is a long time? He asked. A light and a dark? Many lights and darks, she said. Many ground shakes would come and go. The plants would make many more buildings fall. Small things would grow and old things would die. The tall man growled, and the woman staggered back from the force of his anger. But she had another thought, and she forced her way forward to give it to him. It was a machine with arms and knobs and treads, and she imagined it standing before the wall, using its own cutting flames and pounding knobs to shatter the stone. With contempt, he dismissed the idea. He imagined himself standing side by side with the machine, striking the wall himself, neither of them doing any harm to its surface. She shook her head, a sign he'd come to understand, and changed his image. In it, he became smaller and smaller until he was nothing but a tiny dot standing beside one of the machine's treads. He scowled at her, not understanding. She showed herself beside the machine, as well as him, also tiny, and drew him into her eyes. He saw through them as she looked up and up and up at the machine. He understood then. He hadn't shrunk. He'd misunderstood. The machine was vast, the width of a gap between buildings, as tall as this enormous chamber. The tall man laughed. The woman and all the other workers suffused with his humor, also laughed. Weaker than he, they laughed until they coughed, laughed until they fell over, while he watched them in good cheer. Only when some of them began coughing out blood did he relent. He stood over the woman with all the thoughts and made one of her own. In it, she found one of those machines and brought it here. She nodded, but too weak to obey immediately. It was minutes before she could rise and go about her new errand.
Speak, Savang La said.
Nen Yim straightened from her bow.
I have subjected the samples I took from your arm to analysis.
Is my situation favorable?
It is war, Master. The cure to your situation is no more complicated than refusing any further treatments at the hands of Githra Dal. Material I found upon your arm. Material that must have come from Githra Dal touching you inspires the Radank leg to continue growing. It is absorbed into your skin and carried into the depths of your arm by the Carrion Eaters. Remove the material, and the condition should end.
Yet, if I were to discontinue treatment at the hands of Githra Dal, he would know that I suspect him.
Wisely, Nen Yim chose not to reply. Whether she had an opinion on the matter or not, she knew it was not her place to advise the War Master on matters of strategy. Any recommendation she could make would not be well received.
Can you shape a material that would negate the effects of Githra Dal's doings while allowing him to continue to treat me?
Perhaps, War Master. But the material that coaxes your Radank leg to grow as it does is very subtle, very complex. It could take some considerable time to shape a defensive material. Time or access to Githra Dal's shaping chambers.
Savang La considered, then nodded.
I will find a way to give you one, if not both. Withdraw.
When she was gone, he allowed himself to revel in an all-too-rare moment of simple elation. Doom was not upon him. The gods did not punish him. He faced nothing more serious than treachery. And treachery was something he well knew how to deal with. Less familiar to him was the notion of reward, especially as it applied to one who was not Yuuzhan Vong, one who was not a loyal warrior or advisor.
"Send in Vicky Shesh," he said.
Vicky entered the chamber, somewhat thrown off her rhythm by the fact that her escort guards, instead of staying beside her as she passed through the portal, remained behind. Once the senator representing Kuat before the New Republic, she had for a long time also been a spy for the Yuuzhan Vong. Long and faithfully had she served her new masters. But long and faithful service hadn't meant much to them. As the Yuuzhan Vong invasion of Coruscant had begun, she had attempted to carry out her latest assignment, the kidnapping of Ben, the infant son of Luke and Mara Jade Skywalker, and had failed. Threatened with death, she stalled for time. She suggested to Savang La that he had been betrayed by the Shapers. Shesh insinuated their deception was preventing his new limb from healing, threatening to turn him into a shamed one. Now, she hesitated just within the chamber, her quick glance taking in the presence of Savang La on his seat of command, of his advisors and servants staying well away along the walls.
"I have summoned you," the War Master said, "to acknowledge that you do indeed have worth. Your analysis of the situation with my arm was correct. I was afflicted with treachery. I offer you my congratulations."
Vicky actually felt her knees go weak. It wasn't from relief at being proven right. No, the story she'd concocted was supposed to be one that would buy her a considerable amount of time to find a way to escape. But she'd been right. The conspiracy had been rooted out, and her time was at an end. Blast the conspirators. Blast them for existing, for being clumsy enough to be detected so early, for fouling up her plan. She didn't let her smile waver. "The fact that I am of some service brings joy to my heart," she said. "I hope that I shall continue to be of worth to you."
"You shall. And for your next assignment, you will travel to Coruscant below us. Yuuzhan Vong warriors have died there, and the burns that killed them suggest strongly that Jedi are the culprits. You will go with the Nua Ku and join a search unit there. You will offer your insight to the warriors who will run the Jedi to ground. You will have the opportunity to distinguish yourself further in my service."
Words nearly failed her. On an expedition into the ruined world's depths, she'd be watched at least as closely as she'd been observed here. She offered the War Master her most alluring smile and bowed again. The gesture gave her time to find her voice.
"I live to obey, War Master."
Now he had a name. It had taken time and frequent yanking of thoughts out of their heads for him to understand names. Sounds that belonged only to one being. Each of them had a name, and when he understood that, it became vital for him to have one too. He was more powerful, more important than any of them. It was not right for them to have names and him not to. So they called him Nyax, Lord Nyax. Nyax was his name, and no other might have it. Lord was a thing that made his name bigger, better. Lord meant that he was more important than anything. Satisfied with that recognition of his status, he smiled up at the workers crawling over the surface of the tall, tall machine. They repaired it. They cleared rubble from around it. Soon it would go. Soon it would knock down the black wall he hated. Soon he, Lord Nyax, would have everything he wanted, which was everything. All beings would do his bidding. except perhaps those whom his senses could not detect. They were surprisingly resistant to pain. Them he would kill. Every one.
I hate this, Luke said.
Waiting?
Mara, eyes closed, adjusted her pose, trying to make herself comfortable. As comfortable as one could be, propped up against a deformed metal wall in a hallway dripping with rainwater that had filtered through 30 or 40 stories of ruined skyscraper above, on a planet ruled and increasingly ruined by alien enemies. Of course, waiting. Luke had returned half an hour before from the latest scattering run. Not everyone was back. A few meters down the hallway, Danny was cataloging plant samples, and Baljus and Elisar were playing sabacc underneath a flickering glow light. The others were still unaccounted for. Then Mara opened her eyes and looked back down the hall. Luke felt it too. Not danger, but some agitation expressed through the Force. He rose and put his hand on his lightsaber hilt. Up through a hole in the floor swung Tahiri. She landed and extended a hand down, helping face up to this level. She was somber. He looked dubious. When she saw Luke, she gulped. Not out of uncertainty or fear, Luke thought, but out of nausea.
I found something, she said.
Tahiri led them to the doors of a turbo lift. They opened readily enough when Luke neared them, spilling bright artificial glow out onto the floor. He peeked within. The control panel had only three settings: maintenance, housing, and research.
Research, Danny said.
Luke snorted. I knew you'd say that.
We all did, Bindi said. But I have no objection.
It was an expansive scientific complex. This floor had indeed been a scientific research station, decades in the past. Computer systems dating from before Luke's birth lay under dust covers, and Danny identified one long, unused laboratory as being devoted to cellular analysis. The most curious feature of the floor, however, was a chamber to one side of the laboratories. It held nothing more than a long apparatus that looked like a bed with a lid.
A hermetically sealed sleeping unit, Bindi suggested. An Imperial-era suspended animation unit, Baljus corrected. Especially engineered, rather than a production unit, since whatever was in it was nearly 3 meters tall. Not human.
Privately, Luke disagreed. The characteristic of the chamber that many of the others couldn't detect was that it reeked of the dark side of the Force. It was the source, or at least a source, of the disquiet he had felt. And it somehow suggested humanity to him. Humanity at its worst. The transparisteel cover had been thrown aside with such strength and violence that it was warped, the hinges along one side and locking latch on the other broken.
The way I read it, Faye said, this thing woke up, busted out, destroyed all the droids around it. With just its strength, you'll notice, because there are no burn marks on the droids in here or on the suspended animation unit. When it gets into other parts of the complex, it gets its hands on a lightsaber and finishes the job.
Luke nodded.
That could be it. But how did it get out of this complex?
Minutes later, they had their answer. Two levels above, on the floor that had been marked maintenance, Tahiri pointed upward into what had been a machinery access niche. The metal panel that had been the niche's ceiling was gone. The edges of the hole were burned.
This leads to a water and atmosphere supply shaft, she said. It has pipes in it, but also plenty of open space. I climbed up a pretty good distance. It leads up to a hole in a wall a couple of levels up from the chamber with the red goo.
Is the hole easy to access? Bindi asked. Tahiri shook her head.
Not for normal people. It's about 5 meters up on a 10-meter wall. But anybody with a ladder could get up to it.
Especially obvious? No, it's on one side of a storage house, full of carpeting and wall decorations, really useful stuff. No sign of people there. Why? Because, Bindi said, in addition to this mystery of a 3-meter-tall dark Jedi, we have here a complex that still has power, a complex that's hidden from sight. It's big enough to be the headquarters of the first resistance cell I organize. Not a good idea, Luke said. That 3-meter dark Jedi knows where it is. He or she may come back. So we close up its exit hole, hide it, maybe secure that approach against intrusion. Bindi fixed Luke with a grave look. Besides, I suspect that you're not going to let that dark Jedi keep walking around out there, are you? I hope not. Luke looked up the hole. Only a few meters of the water and atmosphere pipes were visible in the dim light from their glow rods. But I don't think it's just a case of it being a dark Jedi. It's very strong, very evil. And I have no idea whether we have enough resources here to stop it. It took only a few hours for Luke and his companions to search the remainder of the scientific station, for Kel and Elisar to locate the other end of the Dark Jedi's escape path and weld a heavy metal sheet across it, for Bindi to get some of the computers operating and extract information from them. Bindi gathered them in an open area on the top level. What we have here, Bindi said, is two different scientific stations put together. Both of them, operations of Imperial Intelligence, dating from about 50 years ago, though this complex has been here for centuries. And this is CPD-113, who has been here since the commencement of the station's third stage of operation. 113?
Greetings, the droid said.
Its voice was thin, cultured, with a distinct Coruscant accent.
I am CPD-113, medical droid, optimized for suspended life process maintenance.
So what was the third stage? Luke asked.
Installation of the systems and organisms needed to maintain the subject. It was an operation that had no significant relation to our primary purpose. But this location, the Bessarian Memorial Atmospheric Reclamation Complex Project substation closest to the Imperial Government Centers, was convenient.
Luke tried to wave the excess verbiage away. What was the subject?
A human male. Combat droids brought him into this complex 13 years ago. Specialized medical droids operated on him and installed him in the suspended animation unit.
Human males don't grow to be 3 meters tall.
They do if subjected to specific growth hormones and cybernetic stimulation for years starting in childhood or adolescence.
So who is this human male?
Unknown, sir. His identity was never provided to us, nor the nature of its armor modifications.
Before Luke could ask, the droid hurried on.
It had hypoallergenic armor plates installed in its torso, head, elbows, and knees. The portions of its brain pertaining to human memory were largely replaced by computer apparatus. We of the maintenance staff concluded that it was to be a war machine of some sort, but beyond that, we knew nothing.
Do you have images of this? Either from before or when it recently emerged? 113 shook its head.
No, sir. We were forbidden by our protocols from recording the subject in any way. Nor do I know what you mean by emerged.
Curious, Luke glanced at Bindi. She said, it appears that their programming on this point was pretty comprehensive. When the subject came out of a suspended animation tank, their programming kicked in, and they couldn't even detect him any longer. He cut them to pieces without them knowing what was happening. Wonderful, Luke said. So, our so-called Lord Nyax is a 3-meter human male with unusual strength, wandering around in a world where it probably doesn't understand anything. That seems to be about the size of it, Bindi said. Isn't the truth liberating? Lord Nyax felt the distant hunger. Something wanted him. That was all right. He wanted it too. Anything that was so anxious for him deserved to be encountered. If it would serve him, he would command it. If it would not serve him, he would cut it into pieces. Either solution was just fine with him. The Yuuzhan Vong hunting party moved through the depths of Coruscant's ruins. Four hard-eyed warriors, the scars, implants, and tattoos on their faces like a star map of pain, led the procession, and four more brought up the rear. Behind those in front were two Voxin handlers and the leashed Voxin they theoretically controlled. The massive reptilian beasts, low to the ground and rippling with muscle, moved their heads back and forth with every few steps, as though they could see through the wreckage around them and view potential victims hiding before them. These Voxin didn't look particularly healthy. In places, their dark green scales were fading to a yellow that reminded Vicky of plants withering from lack of sunlight. Though they were alert, their movements often seemed listless. Not that Vicky would have dared to venture within reach of their teeth or claws. Raglath Noor, the leader of the hunting party, allowed the Voxin and their handlers to take the lead. They passed a side corridor that sloped downward. It was mostly filled with dark liquid and bodies floating atop it. Vicky skidded to a halt and turned back to give it a second look, putting her hand over her nose and mouth as if to reduce the stench. Danua Ku joined her, and other warriors turned back to see what had drawn her curiosity. She pointed at one of the bodies. "Get that one," she said. Danua Ku and one of the others splashed into the water. The body Vicky had pointed out raised its head. He was a male human, young and frightened. He scrambled around in the shallow water and tried to dive away, but Danua Ku caught him by the ankle and yanked. He dragged the screaming, flailing youth back up to the dry cross corridor, then hauled him up by the collar of his tunic and held him against the corridor wall. "How did you know?" Raglath Noor asked. Vicky gave him a superior smile. "He wasn't bloated like the rest."
"Question him," Danua Ku ordered.
Vicky sighed, then turned to their prisoner. "Where are the Jedi?" she asked. The young man shook his head.
"I don't know about Jedi."
Vicky gave him a chill smile. "These warriors would like to kill you. In fact, killing you fast is one of the nicest things they're considering doing to you. So you'd better find some reason, any reason, to give me, so I can persuade them not to. Do you understand?" The young man nodded.
"I know something. I'm going to take something out. Don't kill me."
He reached into a pants pocket. The Voxin roared and surged further down the corridor, dragging their handlers behind them, drawing the attention of the other Yuuzhan Vong warriors. The young man held out his hand. Vicky reached for him, and he dropped something into her outstretched palm.
"It's the ugly."
"Our prey is close," Raglath Noor said. "We don't need him."
Vicky turned toward him and crossed her arms, a gesture she hoped would hide the object the prisoner had given her.
"I'm not through."
But Danua Ku exerted himself, and Vicky heard the snap of the young man's neck. Danua Ku dropped the corpse back into the dark pool.
"Now he will bloat."
Vicky glared at him. Raglath Noor set the warriors into motion, following the frantic Voxin.
"What did the human want to show you?"
Vicky shrugged. "I might have found out if Danua Ku hadn't been so quick to exterminate him." She waited until Raglath Noor's attention was on the Voxin before she tucked the object out of sight under the neckline of her robe skin. She got a glimpse of it before it was concealed. It seemed to be a tiny remote, one with a pair of buttons on one side, another button, and a screen so small as to be nearly useless on the other. The ugly what? The handlers, dragged by the Voxen, were first to pass through the ruined metal doors, which were three times the height of a human and broad enough to permit 10 pedestrians walking side by side. The lettering above the door read, "Elegiac Fabrications, the comfort you deserve." Raglath Nur paused outside the doorway and stared with suspicion at the darkness beyond. He whirled on Vicky.
"What is this?"
"A manufacturing plant," she said. "They manufacture furnishings. Very expensive, very functional furnishings."
"Such as what?"
"Such as chairs that convert into extravagantly comfortable beds. Chairs that carry their owners about in the air. Furnishings that massage those who sit in them."
"Massage?"
Evidently, that didn't translate well through Raglathnur's Tizo worm.
"Inflict pain?"
"Inflict pleasure."
The warrior gave her a revolted look and led his fellows into the darkness. Vicky, alongside Danua Ku, followed. She heard the Voxen's hisses go from excited to ferocious, heard their handlers call after them as they yanked leashes free from the handlers' grips.
"Jedi!" called one of the warriors. "Now you die!"
Vicky heard the distinctive snap hiss of a Jedi lightsaber igniting. One point on the far wall of the manufacturing chamber and the ceiling above it were illuminated by red light, moving light. The claws of the Voxen scrabbled as they charged for their prey. Then there was another snap hiss, and another, and another. The distant red glow brightened. Vicky saw the silhouette of a Voxen leaping high, vaulting intervening machinery, backlit by the glow, and then something rose to meet the Voxen in mid-flight. It was not a Jedi, not a lightsaber blade. A block of machinery 2 meters on a side flew up from below and crashed into the leaping Voxen, striking with such force that Vicky heard the creature's bone shatter. The Voxen's body crashed onto the factory's Duracrete floor, and the block of machinery landed upon it, breaking more bones, and stuck there, not bouncing or rolling forward as it should have.
"Forward," Danua Ku said.
He whipped his amphistaff free from his waist and charged after the other Yuuzhan Vong warriors, who now howled in rage and anticipation. Vicky took 2 steps into Danua Ku's wake, and then something crashed into her, took her from her feet, slapped her to the Duracrete. It was not a physical thing. It was despair and hatred, loathing and worthlessness, fear and howling rage. She heard the howl of the second Voxen, heard the ripping noise of the creature vomiting its acid at its prey. Then there was the sound of lightsabers swinging, hacking, meat in great quantities slapping down onto Duracrete. Vicky writhed in time with the war cries of the Yuuzhan Vong, and one by one, she heard them die under the almost musical tones of the lightsabers. Then there was only the sound of lightsabers cutting and cutting and cutting. The emotional agony that had gripped Vicky lessened, only a little. She managed to roll over onto her stomach and slowly, painfully came upright. She knew the beings on the other side of the chamber had just killed everything that had entered the chamber with her. She wanted nothing more than to charge at them, to rip them to pieces with her bare hands. But as she stood, some faint instinct of self-preservation rose within her, and one thought made up of words emerged. Run. Or die. Vicky woke up in absolute blackness and thought for a moment that she might be dead. In a panic, she sat up, but before she came upright, her head banged into something, resulting in a sharp pain to her forehead and a hollow metallic noise. Then she remembered. She'd climbed and climbed, hearing the roars and the lightsaber hums. She'd found side channels from the access duct, ventilation ducts that were smaller and smaller, adequate for a diminutive Kuat woman, but too constricting for whatever might follow her. After a long time of groping along in the dark, she had let exhaustion overcome her. Now she was alone, weaponless and friendless, surrounded by kilometers of crumbling Duracrete and metal in all directions, not to mention thirsty, hungry, and blind. She forced herself to become calm and went through a ritual checklist that helped her regain control of whatever situation troubled her. "Checklist," she began. "One extravagantly capable political strategist whose skills are of no use here. One Yuuzhan Vong robeskin, a living garment whose sole virtue is that it's better than running around naked and matching foot wraps. That's about it." That wasn't quite it. She'd been given something a million years ago, shortly before starting her run. She dug around under the robeskin neckline and held the object that pretty doomed boy had handed her. It fit her palm so that a button fell under her thumb. There were two others on the reverse side. She pressed the first button. A tiny red screen lit up on the remote, illuminating her surroundings. It was a location finder of some sort. A distant object transmitted a regular signal, and this device always pointed in the direction of that object. She pressed one of the buttons on the reverse side. The wireframe image disappeared, replaced by the words, "out of range." She pressed the last button. The device spoke with the voice of a woman. "Remember, pick up a new charge for the speeder, and we're having dinner with the Tucsons tonight." Vicky supposed that the recording would have depressed someone of less personal strength. She didn't even bother to wonder how dinner had gone. The woman who'd recorded the message was gone, either crushed or vaporized or in some slavering idiot stewpot. And her sole virtue was that one of her possessions was now going to benefit Vicky Shesh. Whatever it might lead to, it was, for now, a light source. She rolled over onto her stomach, shining the light in front of her, and began crawling. Vicky stood at the center of what had once been a large living chamber, centerpiece of the apartment of some wealthy business family. The tracking device had led her here, and this was the point that was closest to whatever it indicated. On the little screen, the white dot representing that object and the dot indicating her current position were almost one point. She shrugged. So she hadn't been able to find her way to the object. It might just be a matter of ascending one floor, descending one, searching more diligently to find the spot that gave her access. Then she remembered the out-of-range message she'd received. She held up the remote and depressed that button again. There was a noise, a faint punk of some mechanical apparatus being activated from above her head. She looked up and then jumped aside just in time to avoid a descending ceiling panel. Its bottom edge came down to rest against the floor. She moved around to look up. It was a set of metal stairs, narrow and without rails, leading up into darkness. Breath catching in her throat, she hurried up the staircase. She found herself in a narrow, low corridor that led for 3 meters straight to the wall she had found so impassable. Straight to a corresponding gap in that wall. A gap that was lit from the other side. Before moving on, she looked around and found a small button control by the top of the hidden staircase. She pressed it and the stairs rose, locking into place behind her. The gap in the wall opened into a cylindrical chamber a few meters across. Occupying most of the chamber, resting on its stern was a vehicle, about 12 meters long, squat at its stern, and tapering toward the bow. On the side was stenciled the vehicle's name, Ugly Truth. Vicky felt a slow, wondering smile spread across her face. This was an emergency evacuation vehicle, cunningly hidden away in the event of disaster. But its owners had not been able to get to it in time as Coruscant fell. Who was the youth who'd given her the locator? Son of the vehicle's owners? Now he was dead, and the vehicle was hers. She was free of the Yuuzhan Vong and in possession of an escape from their world. Commander Eldo Davip, captain of the Lusankia, the greatest New Republic ship engaged in the defense of Borleas, took the turbolift down to the Beltway. The Beltway was a central corridor running the length of the Super Star Destroyer from stern to prow. As the turbolift slowed to a halt, he pulled on a pair of darkened goggles. When the lift doors opened, the precaution proved to be an appropriate one. Directly in front of him, mechanics were welding another section onto the apparatus that now filled the forward portions of the Beltway, blocking all movement forward at this point. The outer shell of the apparatus was rolled metal meters thick. Each section of the shell was 100 meters long, open at either end, with the prow end slightly narrower than the stern, allowing the sections to be installed in an overlapping fashion. The mechanics welded them together at the overlaps. Inside the shell were metal cables drawn in intricate weave-like patterns through hardy metal rings on the interior surface of the shells. The pattern of the cables, their carefully monitored tensions, was not only to keep the shell straight and durable along its length. As soon as they were in place, cargo box-sized containers were situated among them, tied off by more cables, instrument packages attached and carefully attuned. The apparatus now stretched a third of Lusankia's length, hidden away in this access shaft. None of the Vong's extraordinary visual sensors could detect its fabrication. None of their strategists could anticipate its use. Davip sighed. Its use would mark the end of his most prestigious command. But prestige wouldn't mean a thing if the Yuuzhan Vong won. So he watched the continued manufacture of the apparatus and wished it well. Baljus Arnjak was beginning to look like he, too, was being Vong-formed. His beard and mustache were growing in, shaggy and in colors that ranged from light brown to black. His beard seemed like a riotous life form not native to this world. Come in, he said, waving the Jedi and Danny into the Lord Nyack's suspended animation chamber. Bindi was already there, perched on a stool. Luke leaned against the wrecked computer console and crossed his arms as though to put up a defense against whatever information was to come. So, who is he? What was he modified for? Baljus nodded as though that was the first pair of questions he'd expected. He is, or used to be, a dark Jedi. His name was Irek Ismaran. Luke frowned, then shook his head. No. That's not possible. Who's Irek Ismaran? Tahiri asked. Luke dug his datapad out of a belt pouch. Like Baljus said, he was a dark Jedi in training. A son either of the Emperor or of one Sarkhev Quest by a woman named Raganda Ismaran. She was a crazy woman who modified her son with computer implants. My sister Leia ran into him on Balsavis, about 15 years ago. He opened the datapad and began scrolling through entries. Though nowhere near as comprehensive as the database he kept in whatever hidden site might serve as the Jedi headquarters, this datapad included an abbreviated listing on every Jedi, Sith, Force-sensitive, or Force-related person or site he had ever encountered in his long searches for knowledge of the Jedi Order. Within moments, he found the file he wanted. A face resolved into clarity on the datapad screen. Aristocratic, handsome, somehow unfinished in a teenaged way, framed by curly dark hair. It was the face of a younger Lord Nyax. Suddenly Luke felt as pale as Lord Nyax. He showed the image to Mara. She nodded. She noted some of the details that appeared on the screen under Irek's name. So he should be about 30 now. Yes, and of normal height. Except, Baljus interrupted, he spent most of the intervening years in that suspended animation chamber, so he's physically younger than his chronological age. As a baby, he'd had a computer apparatus implanted in his brain by his mother. It helped give him enough focus, monomania may be a better word for it, to learn to control the Force far out of proportion to his age. When he was here, that apparatus was augmented to make his control even greater. It apparently stimulates what's left of his brain in ways beneficial to force control. He was equipped with lightsaber weapons, their use part of the hard coding in his brain implant. Luke snapped the data pad shut. How did this happen? Bindi said, It appears that after leaving Belsavis, he and his mother came to Coruscant and hid here. And by here, I mean in this very facility. His mother carefully monitored his progress in the Force, training him so that he'd be the most powerful dark Jedi in existence, and gave him medical treatments to make him much bigger, more imposing, more physically powerful. Then something happened, Balja said. The notes are not exactly clear, but it seems like they found and took on a partner, another dark Jedi, and at some point Irek and the new partner got in a dispute and dueled. The partner was killed, and Irek took a lightsaber thrust right through the skull. He died. Died, Luke said. Technically died, Balgus added. Brain activity ceased. He fell down and didn't move anymore. But his mother and the attendant medical droids were able to maintain his autonomic functions and keep his body alive. Her journal, not surprisingly, gets a bit harder to understand at this point and becomes increasingly demented over the years. But it becomes obvious that she kept his body in suspended animation and had the medical droids insert increasingly sophisticated components into the computer apparatus in his skull. Luke grimaced. With what purpose? I think, Balja said, that she was trying to make him into her son again. An unlikely prospect, since most of the portions of the brain that pertain to memory and the less violent emotions were charred into carbon, and also to make him into a new leader for the Empire. She was just crazy enough to imagine he could be Emperor Irek. Loving son, dark Jedi, and unconquerable tyrant. Luke exchanged a look with Mara. She didn't let any of her emotions reach her face, but he could feel them through the Force. A revulsion for a woman mad enough to keep her own son on the butcher's block like that for so many years. What happened to Raganda Ismaran? He asked. Lord Nyax killed her. He didn't recognize her. She was just another moving shape in the way when he broke out of his holding tank. Balja shook his head. Very nasty business. It gives even mad science a bad name. Does he have any weaknesses? Mara asked. Oh, yes. Balja gestured at the suspended animation unit. He's not ripe. Ripe, Luke repeated. It appears that a groundquake caused some ceiling rubble to drop, damaging the unit. He woke up, burst out, went on a rampage, and fled. But he wasn't due to come out for another couple of years. Balgus pointed at one of the computer consoles. All his operational programming was there, plus the refabricated Irek memories Roganda planned to implant in him, and they weren't transferred over. He has his instincts, he has some combat programming, and he has some deep-level motivations, such as to seek out Jedi and kill them, to seek out hot points of the Force and control them, to conquer the universe, little things like that. But he lacks memories, tactical skills, even language. He's just a predator whose only goal is to dominate. Great, Luke said.